You're listening to Breadbox Media. Find out more at breadboxmedia.com.
You're listening to breadboxmedia.com. The program is Setting the Record Straight, and I'm your host, Chuck Coughlin.
We're going to be discussing another aspect of the unacknowledged inheritance that is part of the foundation of our culture from the Catholic Church and from Christ's message fulfilled through the Catholic Church, manifested through the Catholic Church. The aspect today I'm going to discuss is charity. I draw frequently on the works of Thomas E. Woods. He stated, "The fact that the Catholic Church invented charity as we know it in the West is largely unacknowledged." This is another aspect of the unacknowledged inheritance that has come like a great bounty into our hands from our Catholic ancestors. It was as if there was an ungrateful young generation who had inherited billions of dollars and claimed to have earned it and deserved it themselves, and yet obliterating the memory of their ancestors that earned the money, an unacknowledged inheritance. Thomas Woods tells the story of Pachomius, a pagan soldier in Constantine's army in the 4th century. Pachomius watched in amazement as his fellow Romans brought food to the afflicted men and without discrimination bestowed help on those in need. He was curious and he inquired about these people and found out that they were Catholics. What kind of religion was it, he wondered, that could inspire such acts of generosity and humanity? He began to learn about the faith, and before he knew it, he was on the road to conversion. This kind of amazement has attended Catholic charitable work throughout the ages. Let's take the example of Voltaire, a very prominent propagandist against the Catholic Church. He was awed by the heroic spirit of sacrifice that animated so many of the Church's sons, and especially daughters. About the daughters, he said, "Perhaps there is nothing greater on earth than the sacrifice of youth and beauty, often of high birth, made by the gentle sex, in order to work in hospitals for the relief of human misery, the sight of which is so revolting to our delicacy. People separated from the Roman religion have imitated, but imperfectly, so generous a charity." Unquote. Catholic charity has no peer in the amount and variety of good work it has done, and the human suffering and misery it has alleviated for the last 2,000 years. As a matter of fact, as Thomas Woods has said, the Catholic Church invented charity as we know it in the West. This measure is in both quantity and quality, because there was a qualitative difference that separated the Church's charity from anything that had preceded it. It would be foolish to deny that some noble sentiments were not voiced by the ancient philosophers when it came to helping humanity. Many men of wealth of the past had made impressive and substantial voluntary contributions to their communities, but most ancient giving was self-interested rather than purely gratuitous. The buildings financed by the wealthy prominently displayed their names. Donors gave what they did either to put the recipients in their debt or to call attention to themselves and their great liberality. Stoicism, an ancient school of thought dating back to around 300 BC, was still prominent and a powerful philosophical force in the early centuries after Christ. Sometimes people point to Stoicism as a pre-Christian line of thought that recommended doing good to one's fellow man without expecting anything in return. It is true, the Stoics did teach that the good man was a citizen of the world who enjoyed a spirit of fraternity with all men. And for that reason, they may appear to have been messengers of charity. But they also taught the suppression of feeling and emotion as things unbecoming of a man. A good Stoic should be utterly unperturbed by outside events, even of the most tragic kind. Rodney Stark, a distinguished professor of sociology at Baylor University, describes the Stoic classical philosophy as having regarded mercy and pity as pathological emotions, defects of character to be avoided by all rational men. Since mercy involves providing unearned help or relief, it was contrary to justice. The Roman philosopher Seneca could write, Quote, the sage will console those who weep, but without weeping. Give hospitality to the prescribed and alms to the poor. Restore the son to the mother's tears. Save the captive from the arena, and even bury the criminal. But in all his mind and his countenance will be alike untroubled. He will feel no pity. He will succor. He will do good, for he is born to assist his fellows, to labor for the welfare of mankind, and to offer each one his part. His countenance and his soul will portray no emotion as he looks upon the withered legs, the tattered rags, the bent and emaciated frame of the beggar. But he will help those who are worthy, and like the gods, his leaning will be towards the wretched. But it is only diseased eyes that grow moist in beholding tears in other eyes. I repeat, it is only diseased eyes that grow moist in beholding tears in others' eyes. So an abundance of empathy and sympathy that attended the Catholic charity of later times is an example of the qualitative difference that I referred to earlier. Now, it is true that with the development of Christianity, in parallel, some of the harshness of the early Stoicism began to dissolve. But the ruthless suppression of emotion and feeling that had characterized so much of this school had already taken its toll. It was certainly alien to human nature in its refusal to acknowledge such an important dimension of what it truly means to be human. A Stoic named Anaxagoras, upon learning of his son's death, merely remarked, I never supposed that I had begotten an immortal. Or take Stilpo, another Stoic. When faced with the capture of his native city, the loss of his daughters to slavery, proclaimed that after all he had really lost nothing, since the wise man transcended and rose above his circumstances. So it is only natural that human beings so insulated from the reality of evil might be slow to alleviate its effect on his fellow man. One observer noted that men who refused to recognize pain and sickness as evils were scarcely likely to be very eager to relieve them and others. St. Paul explained that those who do not belong to the community of the faithful should also be accorded the care and charity of Christians, even if they should be enemies of the faithful. This is from Romans 12. Here was a new teaching of the ancient world, a new quality. Another scholar who was a harsh critic of the church said that there can be no question that neither in practice nor in theory, nor in the institutions that were founded, nor in the place that was assigned to us on the scale of duties, did charity in antiquity occupy a position at all comparable to that which it obtained by Christianity. In these pre-Catholic empires, nearly all relief was a state measure dictated much more by policy than by benevolence, and the habit of selling young children, the innumerable expositions of infants, the readiness of the poor to enroll themselves as gladiators, and the frequent famines show how large was the measure of unrelieved distress. Yes, in the early 400s, infanticide did become illegal. Soon after Constantine had converted to Catholicism, slavery was eliminated, gladiatorial games, and various forms of infanticide, including the exposure of undesired infants. Let me be specific about what that means. That means that undesired infants were left out in the street or out in the fields to die of thirst, exposure, the elements, or to be eaten by animals. It was a practice that Catholicism ended. The practice of giving to the poor developed early in Catholic Church history. The faithful's offerings were placed on the altar within the context of the Mass, given prominence, not a side issue. Early Catholics would often fast, consecrating the funds they would have spent on food as a sacrificial offering. St. Just Martyr reports that many people who had loved their riches and their material things prior to their conversion to Catholicism now sacrificed for the poor in a spirit of joy. One could go on at great length citing the good works of the early church, carried out both the lowly and the rich. St. Augustine established a hospice for pilgrims, ransomed slaves, gave away clothing to the poor. He warned people not to even give him expensive garments, since he would only sell them and give the proceeds to the poor. A great number of Catholic hospitals were founded in the early years. I'm going to enumerate some of these in another program devoted to the hospitals. The early church also institutionalized the care of widows and orphans, saw after the needs of the sick, especially during epidemics. During the pestilences that struck Carthage and Alexandria, the Catholics earned respect and admiration for the bravery with which they consoled the dying and buried the dead, at a time when the pagans abandoned even their friends to their terrible fate. In the North African city of Carthage, the 3rd century bishop, St. Cyprian, rebuked the pagan population for not helping victims of the plague, preferring instead to plunder them. I quote him, "No compassion is shown by you to the sick. Only covetousness and plunder open their jaws over the dead. They who are too fearful for the work of mercy are bold for guilty profits. They who shun to bury the dead are greedy for what they have left behind them." St. Cyprian summoned Catholics to action, calling on them to nurse the sick and bury the dead. We might recall that this was still the age of intermittent persecution of Catholics. So the great bishop was asking his followers to help the very people who had at times persecuted them. What did he say to them? He said, "If we only do good to those who do good to us, what do we do more than the heathens and publicans? If we are the children of God who makes his sun to shine upon the good and bad and sends rain upon the just and the unjust, let us prove it by our acts, by blessing those who curse us, by doing good to those who persecute us." It really astounds us to realize how extensive Christian charity was during this age of persecution. It was amazing that it can be said that as compared with their numbers and resources, the charity of the Catholics of this period seems to have surpassed anything that the world has witnessed since. Much more on Catholic charity after the break.
You are listening to Breadbox Media Podcast. Check out our live stream at breadboxmedia.com. Breadbox Media. Get the app, change the world.
You're listening to breadboxmedia.com. The program is Setting the Record Straight, and I'm your host, Chuck Coughlin.
Welcome back. Chuck Coughlin here. During this segment, we will be discussing how the Catholic charity, which was so marked in the early centuries from individual to individual, evolved into institutions that we now know as hospitals. Indeed, the Catholic Church invented the hospital as we know it. Now, many standard Western civilization texts leave this out, but the Catholic Church revolutionized the practice of charitable giving in both the spirit and its applications. You see the results today. They speak for themselves. We have previously unheard of amounts of charitable giving and systematic institutionalized care of widows, orphans, the poor, and the sick. Let's go back in history to where we were at the end of the last segment. We come to the matter of the plagues in the 3rd century. In the city of Alexandria, the Catholic bishop Dionysius recorded that pagans, quote, thrust aside anyone who began to be sick, and kept aloof even from their dearest friends, and cast the sufferers out upon the public roads half dead, and left them unburied, and treated them with utter contempt when they died. He said the Catholics did not spare themselves, but kept by each other, and visited the sick without thought of their own peril, and ministered to them assiduously, drawing upon themselves their neighbors' diseases, and willingly taking over to their own persons the burden of the sufferings of those around them. Stories of Catholic heroism and of their saints and ordinary people abound. There are many of these stories. Saint Ephrem, a hermit in Edessa, was remembered for his heroism when a famine and pestilence struck that city. He coordinated collection and distribution of alms. He established hospitals, cared for the sick, and tended to the dead. When a famine struck Armenia, Catholics lent assistance to the poor regardless of their religious affiliation. Eusebius, the 4th century historian, tells us that As a result of the Catholics' good example, many pagans made inquiries about a religion whose disciples are capable of such disinterested devotion. The Roman emperor who detested Christianity, called Julian the Apostate, complained of Catholic kindness toward the pagan poor. He said, "These impious Galileans not only feed their own poor, but ours also, welcoming them to their agape. They attract them as children are attracted with cakes." I mentioned a moment ago the matter of the creation of hospitals by the Catholic Church. It is open to debate whether institutions resembling hospitals in the modern sense can be said to have existed in ancient Greece and Rome. Many historians have doubted it, while others have been able to point out an unusual exception here or there. These exceptions always involve the care of sick or wounded soldiers rather than of the general population. If by hospital we mean an institution staffed by physicians who made diagnoses and prescribed remedies, and where nursing provisions were also available, the church appears to be the pioneer. As we progressed to the 300s, the Catholic Church began to sponsor the establishment of hospitals on a very large scale, such that every major city ultimately had one. They originally provided hospitality to strangers, but it evolved into caring for the sick, widows, orphans, and poor in general. Catholics had set aside the reciprocal hospitality that had prevailed in ancient Greece and the family-oriented obligations of the Romans in order to cater to particular social groups marginalized by poverty, sickness, and age. Before the birth of Christ, the spirit toward sickness and misfortune was not one of compassion, and the credit for ministering to human suffering on an extended scale belongs to Catholicism. You will often hear me praise St. Fabiola, one of the three women who gave so much assistance to St. Jerome's in translating and compiling the first Bible. St. Fabiola was wealthy and established the first large public hospital in Rome with her own funds. She was a young and beautiful woman, but she went out into the most dangerous districts of Rome, scouring the streets and back alleyways for the sick and the needy, for the poor and infirm men and women in need of care, and conveying them back to her hospital. In Caesarea, in the 300s, St. Basil the Great established a wonderful hospital. He went out and embraced the miserable lepers who sought care, displaying a tender mercy toward these outcasts, for which later St. Francis would become famous. Of course, the monasteries played a great role in the care of the sick as time went on. No surprise here, because following the fall of the Roman Empire, Europe might have fallen into chaos, but for the network of monasteries. The monasteries gradually became the providers of organized medical care not available anywhere else in Europe for several centuries. Given their organization and spread out locations, these institutions were virtual oases of order, piety, and stability, an atmosphere in which healing could flourish. To provide these caregiving practices, monasteries also became sites of medical learning. Between the 5th and 10th centuries, the classic period of so-called monastic medicine. And of course, these monasteries had a network of intellectual exchange, so that by the 800s, they emerged as the principal centers for the study and transmission of medical texts, ancient and modern. I think we've all heard of the Hospitallers, the Knights of St. John. They're very famous. They were an early instance of what later became the Knights of Malta, and they left an especially important imprint. And they left an especially important imprint on the history of European hospitals. Most notably were their unusually extensive facility in Jerusalem. That hospital was established just after the year 1000. It provided for the poor, and it rendered safe and secure lodging for pilgrims, of whom there were many in Jerusalem, particularly after the Catholic victory in the First Crusade at the end of the century. The scope of the hospital's operations increased significantly after Godfrey Bouillon led the Crusaders into Jerusalem and endowed the institution with a string of properties. Now that Jerusalem was in Catholic hands, the routes to the city were open, and more donations began to arrive from other sources. The scale of the place became quite amazing. Observers said that the house feeds so many individuals outside and within, and it gives so huge an amount of alms to the poor people, either those who come to the door or those who remain outside, that certainly the total expenses can in no way be counted. Another observer said, going through the palace, we could in no way judge the number of people who lay there, but we saw 1,000 beds. No king or tyrant would be powerful enough to maintain daily the great number fed in this house. In 1120, the hospitalers elected Raymond Depuy as administrator of the hospitals. Raymond placed dramatic emphasis on service to the sick, who had been entrusted to the hospital's care, and expected the staff to make heroic sacrifices. Article 16 of Raymond's Code says this: when the sick man shall come there, let him be received thus. Let him partake of the holy sacrament, first having confessed his sins to the priest, and afterwards let him be carried to bed, and there as if he were a lord. Raymond's Code became a milestone in the development of future hospitals. So it was hardly surprising that there was a new stream of pilgrims that came to the Latin Kingdom of Jerusalem. There were so many testimonials praising the charity of the Hospitallers of St. John that the influence of that institution spread rapidly throughout Europe, including England. It inspired the creation of a network of similar institutions, especially at ports in Italy and in southern France, where pilgrims assembled. At the same time, grateful ex-inmates, charitable nobles, and royals from one end of Europe to the other provided substantial land donations. King Alfonso of Aragon bequeathed one-third of his realm to the hospitallers. As the 12th century went on, the hospital began to look more and more like a modern hospital and less like a hospice. The hospital's mission became more specifically defined as the care of the sick, as opposed to providing shelter for needy travelers. At first, an institution solely for Catholics, the Hospital of St. John began to admit Muslims and Jews as well. It was also impressive for its professionalism, its organization, and its strict regimen. Modest surgeries were carried out. The sick received twice daily visits from physicians, baths, and two main meals a day. The workers were not permitted to eat until the patients had been fed. This served as a model for Europe, where institutions inspired by the great hospital of Jerusalem began to pop up everywhere, even in modest villages. The hospitallers themselves were administering perhaps 20 hospices and leper houses. Even opponents of the church heaped praise upon the charitable work of Catholics. Julian the Apostate, the Roman emperor who made a futile, if energetic, attempt in the 360s to return the empire to its earlier paganism, conceded that the Catholics outshone the pagans in their charitable work. He said that the hated Galileans devote themselves to work of charity and by a display of false compassion have established and given effect to their pernicious efforts. See their love feasts and their tables spread for the indigent. Such practice is common among them and causes a contempt for our gods. Martin Luther was forced to admit, quote, under the papacy, the people were at least charitable, and force was not required to obtain alms. Today, under the reign of the gospel, by this Luther meant Protestantism, in place of giving, they'd rob each other. And it might be said that no one thinks he has anything till he gets possession of the property of his neighbor. Simon Patton, a 20th century author, said that when we note the number of hospitals and infirmaries, the bounties of the monks, and the self-sacrifice of the nuns, we cannot doubt that the unfortunate of that time were at least as well provided for as they are at the present. More about Catholic charities after the break.
You are listening to Breadbox Media Podcast. Check out our live stream at breadboxmedia.com. Breadbox Media. Get the app. Change the world.
You're listening to breadboxmedia.com. The program is Setting the Record Straight, and I'm your host, Chuck Coughlin.
We've been setting the record straight about the great extent of the Catholic Church's charitable activities. The extent of the Church's charitable activity sometimes became the clearest when it was taken away, such as under King Henry VIII in the 1500s, who suppressed the monasteries, ordered them demolished, which proved somewhat impossible to do, so well built they were. But he confiscated their property, distributing monasteries at rock-bottom prices to men of influence within his realm. He bought off his nobles with the stolen property of the monks, who had labored for 1,100 years to create the paradise that is the rural English countryside, from what had been a series of swamps and morasses and unusable land, the least desirable land, through the labors of the monks had become the most desirable, had become magnificent farmland. Thousands of acres, one-fifth the land area of England, as a matter of fact, was taken from the monks and devoted to the purposes of buying the loyalty of nobles to Henry VIII's new Anglican church, with he himself as the head. England was now a theocracy, which Henry VIII had created because the Pope had denied him an annulment, and thus was created the process of divorce, which now ensured that Henry could attempt to have a male heir to his Tudor throne by putting aside his wife, Catherine of Aragon, in favor of Anne Boleyn, who became Queen Elizabeth's mother. The pretext for the suppression was that the monasteries had become sources of scandal and immorality, though there could be little doubt that such contrived accusations merely conceived royal avarice. The consequences were substantial. The Pilgrimages of Grace, which were a revolutionary rising in 1536, was inspired by popular anger at the disappearance of monastic charity. A great hurt and decay is thereby come, and hereafter shall come to your realm, said one writer, and a great impoverishing of many of your poor obedient subjects, for lack of hospitality and good householding was want in them. To be kept at the great relief of the poor in all areas adjoining the monasteries. The monasteries were known to be generous and easy landlords, making wonderful farmland available at low rents and for leases of long duration, perhaps lifelong. The monastery was a landlord that never died. Its tenants were dealing with a deathless landlord. Its lands and houses never changed owners. Its tenants were liable to none of the many uncertainties that other tenants were. The dissolution of the monasteries and the redistribution of their lands could only mean ruin to scores of thousands of the poorest of the peasantry, the breakup of the small communities which were their world, and a future that was truly beggary. The favorable terms on which people had once worked these lands by and large disappeared. The new owners, shopkeepers, bankers, or needy noblemen, had no attachment to the rural path, and they exploited their lands in a spirit that was solely businesslike. Rents were increased, arable land converted to pasture in large areas enclosed. Thousands of unemployed farmhands were thrown out onto the street. Social distinctions became accentuated, and there was an alarming increase in paupers. During the several centuries following the death of Charlemagne, that was 814, much of the care of the poor was until then mostly the province of the local parish church, but it began to migrate to the monasteries. King Louis IX said that monasteries were the patrimony of the poor, the inheritance of the poor. Indeed, it had been customary ever since the 4th century to speak of all of the church possessions as the inheritance of the poor. But the monasteries distinguished themselves in particular. In every district there were monasteries which formed the centers of organized religious life. Of the neighborhood, they maintained schools, provided models for agriculture, industry, aquaculture, and forestry, sheltered the traveler, relieved the poor, reared the orphans, cared for the sick, and were havens of refuge for all who are weighed down by spiritual or corporal misery. For centuries, the monasteries were the centers of all religious, charitable, and cultural activity. They distributed alms daily to those in need. By the monks, the nobles were overawed. The poor protected, the sick tended, travelers sheltered, prisoners ransomed, the remotest sphere of suffering explored. During the darkest period of the Middle Ages, the monks provided a refuge for pilgrims amid the horrors of Alpine snows. The Benedictines, the Cistercians, as well as the Mendicant orders, the Franciscans, the Dominicans, later on, distinguished themselves in their attention to charitable work. Today, the Roman Catholic Church is the largest non-governmental provider of healthcare services in the world. Its involvement in the field is born of Catholic social teaching. From ancient times, Catholic emphasis on practical charity gave rise to the development of systematic nursing and hospitals, and the Catholic Church remains heavily engaged in the field today. Christ placed a particular emphasis on the care for the sick and the outcast. The Benedictine rule holds that the care of the sick is to be placed above and before every other duty, as if indeed Christ were being directly served by waiting on them. And during the Middle Ages, as we've been discussing, monasteries were the key medical centers of Europe. Recently, in 2010, the Catholic Church's Pontifical Council for Pastoral Assistance to Healthcare Workers said that the Church manages 26% of healthcare facilities in the world. 26%. That includes hospital, clinics, orphanages, pharmacies, and centers for those with leprosy. Earlier in the Middle Ages, the activities of the Catholic Church in this kind of charity has been likened to an early version of a welfare state. The Church conducted hospitals for the old, orphanages for the young, hospices for the sick of all ages, as I've said, places for the lepers, and hostels are in where pilgrims could buy a cheap bed and a meal. It supplied food to the population during famine and distributed food to the poor. The Church funded this welfare system through collecting taxes on a large scale and possessing large farmlands and estates. They'd acquired these very often from the worst land available, following their precept of labor and work or in labora. They converted into arable farmland. It was common for monks and clerics to practice medicine, and medical students at northern universities often took minor holy orders. Medieval hospitals had a strongly Christian ethos, and were, in the words of historian of medicine Roy Porter, religious foundations through and through. Ecclesiastical regulations were passed to govern medicine. This was in part to prevent clergymen from profiting when they provided medical care. In medieval times, there was even a pope, Pope John the 21st, who was a physician and who wrote popular medical texts. If you were to look up on the Wikipedia about hospitals and hospices, many other modern secular references suggest that hospitals began in the 11th century. More knowledgeable historians, like Thomas Wood, have pointed out that by the 4th century, the Catholic Church had begun to sponsor hospitals on a large scale, such that nearly every major city had one. Why don't we return again to the early centuries after Christ and talk again about St. Fabiola? She renounced all that the world had to offer her and devoted her immense wealth to the needs of the poor and the sick. As an act of penance, she erected a fine hospital at Rome. It was the first hospital at Rome. Besides all this, she gave large sums to the churches and religious communities in Rome and all through Italy. Later, she went to Bethlehem, where she lived in the hospice of the convent directed by St. Paula, and applied herself under the direction of St. Jerome with the greatest zeal to the study and contemplation of the scriptures and to ascetic exercises. And we know that she, Jerome, Paula, and Paula's daughter Eustochium were the four people that worked on the translation and compilation of the Vulgate Bible. So as we mentioned, that after the fall of the Roman Empire, the monasteries became the providers of medical care for centuries. The 5th to the 10th century was the great period of monastic medicine. Around the 10th century, the Crusades occurred, and the military orders established and administered hospitals all over Europe. During the Crusades, centering around the year 1000, the military orders established and administered hospitals all over Europe. The Knights of St. John created a very large hospital in Jerusalem. Whereas the Church did not invent places like hospitals, what was new was the extent and scale and the sense of mission. Christ's healing miracles are a central activity assigned to the apostles. The situation with hospitals and the creation of them is similar to the Catholic Church's creation of the real university, the authentic university. Whereas other cultures had indeed a learning center, the complete and true university, as we know it today, was a Catholic innovation, just as the hospital was, as we know it in magnitude and in professionalism. Let's talk about France, about Paris. In 1789, the French Revolution confiscated church property. The result was that in 1847, France had 47 fewer hospitals than in 1789. And the 50,000 students in the universities had dwindled to a mere 12,000. The Hôtel Dieu de Paris, God's Hotel, is regarded as the oldest hospital in the city of Paris, France. The number of its beds has varied through the years from 2,400 to 5,000. It is the most central of the hospitals. The hospital is linked to a medical school. It still resides on the left bank of the Île de Cité, next to Notre Dame Cathedral, where the facility was originally built between the 7th and the 17th century, with the two buildings being linked by a bridge. Although the facility has been ravaged by disastrous fires on several occasions, the hospital remains in existence today. The current architecture dates back only to 1877. As a symbol of charity and hospitality, it was the first hospital in Paris until the Renaissance. It was founded by Saint Landry, in 651, quite a while ago. We'll be back after the break.
You are listening to Breadbox Media Podcast. Check out our live stream at breadboxmedia.com. Breadbox Media. Get the app. Change the world.
You're listening to breadboxmedia.com. The program is Setting the Record Straight, and I'm your host, Chuck Coughlin.
We've been discussing Catholic charity, and especially concentrating on the hospital, the Catholic creation of the hospital. It's important to give some context to this. Among the tribes of the ancient Germans, pre-Christian, the sick and feeble were often put to death. In Ireland, by 300 BC, they had created a hospital, Princess Mochab. It was called the House of Sorrow and was used by the Red Branch Knights and served as the royal residence in Ulster until its destruction in 332. Some other cultures had established hospitals. In India, the Buddhist king Asoka, 252 BC, established a hospital for men and animals. The Mexicans in pre-Columbian time had various institutions in which the sick and poor were cared for. In a general way, the advance in medical knowledge implies that more was done to relieve suffering, but it does not necessarily prove the existence of hospital. The Egyptians certainly employed a considerable number of remedies, and the physicians held clinics in the temples. Similar customs prevailed in Greece in the hope of receiving directions from the god through dreams, which the priests interpreted. The Romans, in their treatment of the sick, adopted many Greek customs. Municipal physicians were appointed to treat various classes of citizens. Both Greeks and Romans regarded disease as a curse inflicted by supernatural powers, and rather sought to propitiate the malevolent deity than to organize the work of relieving the patient. On the other hand, the virtue of hospitality was quite generally insisted upon. And this trait, as we know, holds quite a prominent place in Christian charity. Like other works of Catholic Christian charity, the care of the sick was from the beginning a sacred duty for each of the faithful, but it devolved in a special way upon the bishops and the deacons. The same ministrations that brought relief to the poor naturally included provision for the sick who were visited in their homes. One institution that needs a special mention is God's Hotel, Hôtel Dieu, in Paris. It seems to have been founded around 660 A.D., and it's been attributed to Landry, Bishop of Paris. As you might suspect, it belongs to that group of institutions which grew up in connection with a cathedral or with the principal church of each large city, for which no precise state can be assigned. The Hôtel Dieu exists today, after 14 centuries. The Hôtel Dieu usually had 2,400 patients, and at times 5,000 patients. Now, over in the New World, in the 1500s, Cortes erected a hospital sometime before 1524 in Mexico City, in gratitude, as he declared in his will, quote, for the graces and mercy God had bestowed on him in permitting him to discover and conquer New Spain, and in expiation or satisfaction for any sins he had committed, especially those he had forgotten. It is still in existence, and its superintendents are appointed by the descendants of Cortes himself. Pope Clement VII conferred on Cortes the perpetual patronage of this and other similar institutions to be founded by him. Within the first decade after the conquest, the Hospital of San Lazaro is founded with accommodation for 400 patients. And the Royal Hospital, also in Mexico City, was established in 1540. In 1541, Cortes ordered hospitals to be erected in all Spanish and Indian towns. Now that's Central America. Now moving to North America, let me pick just one example. In 1720 in New Orleans was created the first private hospital in the United States. It is now the City Hospital, still run by the Sisters of Charity. The total number of hospitals erected by Cortes in these Indian towns was 1,540. You may have noticed that today we're in the midst of a controversy over the Catholic hospitals being forced to sin to comply with immoral government laws. Some Catholic hospitals may be forced out of business. Some people are questioning why the Catholic Church even has a connection with hospitals. One recent letter to the editor in the Lexington Herald Leader said, the government should run hospitals. Why is the Catholic Church even involved in hospitals? Well, it's apparent that the record needs to be made known in order for that record to be set straight. A quick answer is that the first international network of high-quality hospitals, as we know them, the Care for All, no matter who they are, was originated more than 16 centuries ago by the Catholic Church. The Church has always been the largest non-governmental provider of health care services in the world. Women, especially nuns, have played a prominent role in these institutions throughout history. Really, the most prominent role. The Apostle James, in his epistle, writes in 2:24, you see that a person is justified by works and not just by faith alone. This ethic of charity is a foundation stone of the truly Catholic life. The Benedictine rule holds that the care of the sick is to be placed above and before every other duty, as if indeed Christ were being directly served by waiting on them. Although many societies have had shamanic healing, rituals of healing, often enacted in temples, this has happened in ancient China, Egypt, Rome, under the Roman Stoics. These are to be praised, but they were very different than the Catholic hospital. Much smaller in scale and treating only certain families, classes, or military groups. Quite beyond this and deeper, of much deeper importance, that these societies were usually informed by a much more hard-hearted sensibility. A great difference in treatment of the ill arises from the conviction that every person is to be treated as if they were Christ, as if everyone has a soul, as if everyone is sacred. What results is a radical charity, a radical caritas that inspires us to care for our enemies. Caritas, charity, love, caritas. For a contrasting example, in ancient Mexico, the temple rituals centered on mass human sacrifices, followed by cannibalism. In one instance, a four-day festival, 80,000 were sacrificed in one temple, in one four-day period. In all these societies, the sick, the feeble, and unwanted infants were most often killed. Even from the beginning, the cultural sensibility that informed Catholic hospitals is so tenderly loving and self-sacrificing in quantity and quality and sensitivity that has been recognized as unique even by the church's most ardent adversaries. Most people have no idea that they've inherited a fortune from the Catholic Church. It's an unacknowledged inheritance, a beautiful patrimony of a magnificent culture, of kindness and great sensitivity, caring first for the poorest, the weakest, the least significant, the one who is less. This is not only a record that needs to be made straight, it needs to be uncovered at all. Christ's admonition to love one's enemy has no greater employment than the long, consistent history of Catholic hospitals. The practice of caring for everyone who is in need, whether they're family, friends, countrymen, or someone of a different race, sinners, criminals, even enemy combatants. In the USA, there's 600 Catholic hospitals. That's 12% of the total. Would you think that this is the typical percentage in most countries of the world, about 12%? It's not. The U.S. is rich and can afford many public hospitals, and they have them. Elsewhere, the picture is different. A non-Catholic friend who was employed in food relief for the UN and had traveled through most of the undeveloped world told me that hospitals one encounters in the third world were almost always Catholic hospitals. There's a strong connection between the monastery's major role in the development of the scientific method and of science. It has played a major role in all types of sciences and their application in the healing sciences and the healing arts. In the recent history of the United States, visionary nuns have established, managed, and staffed the hospitals. And quite a while back, they were sitting on the hospital boards and serving as administrators at a time when women rarely occupied positions of leadership in business. They brought to the service a unique cultural sensibility, that of giving over the whole of their lives to caring for the infirm. This discussion reminds me of Alexantonian, who was my mother's beloved friend, classmate, and third cousin. Her name was Marie McKenna. She later became a Maronite nun, Sister Mary DeLillis. She told us that one of her duties as a missionary in China in the 1940s was to patrol the muddy streets before dawn and find and rescue the newborn babies who, fresh from the warmth of their mother's wombs, had been tossed out into the night to die. They had been exposed. Sister Mary DeLillis went out in the worst weather, gathered them up from the muddy streets, took them to a Catholic hospital to begin their lives. Perhaps in reply to the person who wrote the letter to the Lexington, Kentucky Herald Leader, saying, "Why is the Catholic Church running hospitals?" Maybe we should answer that saving just one of those baby girls is a sufficient reason why the Catholic Church should run hospitals. I hope you've enjoyed this. This is Setting the Record Straight. It's Charles Coughlin. God bless you.
This is BreadboxMedia.com. Thanks for listening and God bless you.
Thank you for listening to Breadbox Media Podcast. Check out our live stream at BreadboxMedia.com. Breadbox Media. Get the app, change the world.